Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
From the Beck Agricultural Center on the Purdue University campus in West Lafayette, Indiana, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, hosting their field day here. Thanks to the folks at Purdue Extension for inviting me over. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. And we'll take a longer look at soybean production and what the Extension specialists here have to say about insects and weeds and growing degree days, and we'll do that all on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our term of the day is liquidity. In business, economics, or investment, market liquidity is an asset's ability to be sold without causing a significant movement in the price and with minimum loss of value. Money or cash is the most liquid asset and can be used immediately to perform economic actions like buying, selling, or paying debt, meeting immediate wants and needs. However, currencies, even major currencies, can suffer loss of market liquidity in large liquidation events. A liquid asset has some or all of the following features. It can be sold rapidly, with minimal loss of value, any time within market hours. The essential characteristics of a liquid market is that there are always ready and willing buyers and sellers. A market may be considered deeply liquid if there are ready and willing buyers and sellers in large quantities. This is related to market depth that can be measured as the units that can be sold or bought for a given price impact. The opposite is that of market breadth, measured as the price impact per unit of liquidity. An illiquid asset is an asset which is not readily saleable due to uncertainty about its value or the lack of a market in which it is regularly traded. The liquidity of a product can be measured as how often it is bought and sold. This is known as volume. Often investments in liquid markets, such as the stock markets or futures markets, are considered to be more liquid than investments such as real estate, based on their ability to be converted quickly.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalo. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to helping farm families succeed by offering financial products and services geared specifically to agriculture and rural communities and developing partnership-based relationships with its member owners.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm UofI Extension's Todd Gleason on this Thursday afternoon at Purdue's Field Day here at the Beck Agricultural Center outside of West Lafayette, Indiana. We're now joined by Dan Zwicker. He's at Zwicker Consulting out of Waco, Texas. Hey, Dan, thanks for being with us. Let's jump right into it. Soybeans had a pretty good couple of days. And while we're not at the end of the day when we're talking now, maybe you can go through where you think we stand.
Well, soybeans is where all the shorts are at. I mean, the small short, if they're short anything, they're short soybeans. So soybeans are where the shorts are at. So anything that comes along that would be generally price supportive, then you'll get that short covering to take place. And, of course, the short covering then improves the overall chart pattern outlook, so then you get new technical buying. And I believe a lot of that was probably put in the soybean market. The thing the soybean market has is it doesn't have the old crop inventory problem that corn has had, and that's why soybeans have been able to kind of recover. Well, we're basically sitting here about a 38% retracement of what we lost off of the June-July high points. So soybeans have been able to actually recover at least a significant portion of what they lost, whereas corn has only been able to retrace about 3% of what it lost off of the summer high. And I think a lot of that is soybeans, old crop soybeans, farmers didn't have very many left. They were already priced into the marketplace. We continue to see weakness in the dollar. Overall export demand for soybeans still remains very good, even with all the concerns of possible sanctions against China, possible doing away with NAFTA and all that kind of stuff. Soybeans still have good demand. That might even actually be encouraging demand. I think there's still a general belief out there that maybe these private estimates of soybeans still may be a smudgeon high, and the balance sheet's not quite as loose as what these private estimates have. We still have a ways to go yet. Technically, soybeans are, they're at this 38% retracement point on the chart. This is a resistance spot, and you're starting to see that we are having, it is a hard spot to get through. But if we would actually begin to really clear this level, it would open the gates then for like a 62% retracement, which would kind of take November beans up into the 990s. So that's kind of what I'm looking at from a technical perspective. If we can come in here and kind of clear this 38% retracement level decisively, then the technicians then would kind of play for a move up into the 990s. The same thing here with corn. Corn's got more of a fundamental problem, even though some of the yield estimates that we're hearing from private guys is coming down a little bit from USDA's August number, but overall corn supplies are going to be considered burdensome. You almost need to get that national average yield down well below the 165 level, and at least the private estimates that we have seen up to this point doesn't do that. So we have a fairly large inventory of corn, a lot of old crop corns around. So the corn futures December has only been able to retrace 23%. So for the most part, you call that as a technical bounce or a dead cat bounce. Now, if corn, December corn, would begin to clear this 362 area, 363, then all of a sudden it kind of opens the door to kind of go back to the 50% retracement level, and then that would be up around the 380 level. So those are the kind of things that, as a technician, that I'm looking at.
that would maybe spur this market, give it a little more pre-harvest technical bounce. But I do know harvest activity is beginning to take hold, and I suspect 2 weeks from now we're going to have a lot of harvest activity, and we're going to probably know a little bit more about what the yield actually really is. USDA's numbers coming out next week, supply demand tables, who knows? I think, you know, you can tell by the private estimates that they think USDA could come down a little bit, especially on corn, may not so on soybeans. We'll just have to kind of take it from there. But we had an awfully bearish August. So we're starting out a little firmer here during the first week of September. If this is able to extend itself into a solidly higher weekly close, that would at least give an indication to me that maybe we're going to go counter seasonal during September. You know, September is one of these dominantly down months, 8 out of 10 years roughly. You close lower during the month of September, and markets work their way into kind of like an October harvest low during the first half of October. Since we had such a bearish August, it looks like September is starting out, could be counter-seasonal, and providing we don't get anything real bearish thrown at us, this counter-seasonal move may extend into more of a seasonal move, because the seasonals then begin to turn up in October and November, and then that would give the market a little more upside potential once the seasonals begin to turn higher during the month of October.
Dan Zwicker is with Zwicker Consulting from Waco, Texas. Well, you're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Thursday afternoon. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason here at the Beck Agricultural Center at Purdue, where it is a field day. We're joined by John Obermeyer. He's an entomologist here, was discussing with some of the farmers that are out and about earlier today, IPM, or Integrated Pest Management. Let's deal with neonicotinoids in general. You were talking to them about Cruiser, which is a neonicotinoid on soybeans, and the idea that maybe this seed treatment might not be utilized all season long. Why is that the case?
Well, as I was expressing with the group, is seed treatments, the insecticidal seed treatments, are certainly one of many tools that we can utilize in controlling pests. And I was bringing up with the group just particular soybean aphid and bean leaf beetle. And there are places, especially with bean leaf beetle, where the soybean treated seed is beneficial, in that it's is with very early planted soybean. But with the soybean aphid, we don't see the benefit because those come on later, and the neonicotinoid insecticide is completely gone by then.
So then, as this disappears throughout the season, your concern is that they're putting on a prophylactic version of a neonicotinoid to protect against insects that probably are not going to be there and affected by the neonic.
Correct. We want to utilize each and every tool that we have in our IPM box to the best of our abilities. And unfortunately, with the insecticidal seed treatments, we often overutilize those. In other words, depend on them too much for where they really don't fit in with control, such as soybean aphid.
And finally, because neonics are used across most corn acres in the United States, do you have concerns about the development of resistance in insects?
All of my colleagues and myself have that concern for the near future. Yes.
Thank you so much.
All right. My pleasure.
That was John Obermeyer. He's an entomologist here at Purdue. Of course, we're at the field day here in Lafayette, Indiana, at the Beck Agriculture Center. Bill Johnson is here. He's weed scientist for Purdue. He's making presentations to the producers that are here. Your job today is to talk, I think, about dicamba, resistant weeds. What's your primary message?
Well, there's a couple of things that we're trying to communicate to our growers today, and one of them is to let them know that as far as managing mare's tail, now's the time of the year where they need to start thinking about managing mare's tail. Fall applied herbicides, do something else in the spring to control the myristoyl that come up in the spring, and then just be diligent and realize that it's a year-long battle to control that weed. With water hemp, we're trying to get guys educated on where it comes from. And basically, they need to be looking at their fields this time of year to look at the fields that have a few escapes in them, knowing that these weeds can produce a whole bunch of seed. And if they run that seed through the combine, they're going to spread it out. And then next year, they're going to call me and ask me where it came from. So we're trying to make sure they know that they have it. And number two, some of the management tactics for it as well. And then finally, we're talking a little bit about the dicamba product, the dicamba problem that we have here in the Midwest and in the Mid-South region, kind of the scope of it, what we think led to some of the problems, and what we see as potentially some of the solutions for it going into next year.
What are some of the solutions? There are things that we hear now that go as far as just simply taking the product off of the marketplace.
Well, one of the things that will become a law here in Indiana is it will become a restricted use pesticide, so we can track the sales more closely and try to get a handle on the use of generic product versus the approved formulations. But the other things that are being discussed are things like a cutoff date, tightening the hours up during the course of the day when it can be sprayed, tightening up the wind restrictions, and a few other things as well, but those are kind of the main ones.
So these all go back to kind of the area that Monsanto, Rob Fraley, in fact, I know when we talked with him last week at Farm Progress Show, was talking about, and I'll just lump it all into operator error area, one where they may have actually purchased the wrong product and used it on dicamba resistant beans. The others are related to how late, I think, in the season they might use it, as well as what time of day.
Yeah, I think the key thing to keep in mind is in terms of Indiana, we almost had the perfect storm of conditions that would lead to problems with regards to our weather patterns. Once it finally was dry enough to spray post-emerge dicamba in most of the state, the winds were blowing at gale force, and then you are applying a higher amount of AI during the time of the year when it's warmer, which, you know, typically we don't do in Indiana anyway. And so we had a lot of situations kind of related to these sequence of events that forced us to make applications during less than ideal conditions. But I think the other thing to keep in mind as well is that there is a message coming from industry that the new formulations did not have any volatility characteristics, when in fact there's no such thing as a non-volatile dicamba product out there.
So this was the question I was going to follow up with. There are many who believe that the volatility is there, that this product is capable of getting up and moving 3-4 days maybe after it is sprayed.
Yes, and some of the work that's been done so far, and we've really had a very limited opportunity to work with these products to test volatility, it has been shown to move up to 48 hours after application.
You and your colleagues across the country would have preferred to take a look at this product, other products ahead of time. That's not been the case. Is there a way that you can find a solution?
Great question. You know, solutions are going to be complicated. They're going to be complicated by the fact that, you know, we do have limited hours to make spray applications, and the fact that we, as of right now, we don't have a product that is non-volatile. And so you throw all those things together, and I think we can tighten up some things in terms of application parameters. And I certainly think the companies can do a little more work to help reduce the volatility even more. I do think they have the capability of that aspect with the chemists that they have. But it's going to take a concerted effort by the entire industry to make sure we do as many things right as possible.
In the end, though, this is a 50-year-old product. There aren't any new solutions on the marketplace for soybeans and weed control.
In the short term, these tools are a big help for controlling herbicide-resistant broadleaf weeds. There's no getting around that. We need them. What I'm hopeful of is that we don't fall into this trap of using this technology like we did Roundup Ready, where we just spray Roundup until we run out of time or money or weeds or something and drive resistance as fast as we did Roundup Ready.
Thank you so much.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Bill Johnson. He's a weed specialist. We've been talking, of course, about soybeans here at Purdue's Field Day. Let's continue with that conversation. They have a soybean specialist, actually. His name is Sean Castile. He now joins us. Sean, farmers are wondering two different things at this time of year as it relates to soybeans, although this isn't normal at this time of year. We had a very cool month of August, the 12th in the state of Illinois, at least. Most cool August on record, and it looks, according to the meteorologist we talked to, that September will remain cool. That means the growing degree days aren't piling up. Now, soybeans generally are a sun-driven senesce. However, I'm wondering what a lack of growing degree days will mean.
Sure. When you look at August and September, soybeans, we used to think just August makes or breaks soybeans. And that's true, but it's really August and September. You go back a year ago for us, Illinois is the same way. Some of the best yields we've ever had in soybeans. And it came down to the weather we had in August and in September. So we had great sunlight, good temperatures, good soil moisture. Now go to today. We've got cooler temperatures. Sunlight's there, okay, but not the heat units that you alluded to. Soil moisture, it's kind of a hit and miss. So that August, that was cooler. Probably was good for those areas that didn't have the soil moisture, so they retained those pods. Those that had the soil moisture and the cooler temperatures, not quite as good in terms of pod retention and seed fill. Really more about the seed fill at this point. And then now we're in jackets in September, and it's cool. Forecast is going to be continue to be cool, so we're not going to be packing on as much dry matter on each seed throughout this period. It'll be a slower seed fill, and usually at this point, whenever we're looking at leaves that are remobilizing nutrients, not as much nitrogen there, and these cooler nights that we're in, these 40s and 50s, they're not going to rebound. Even if we got back in the 85 degree weather, good sunlight, good soil moisture, their photosynthetic capacity is not going to be at the same level. So they're not going to get back, even if we magically get warmer temperatures, to that same level. So in other words, slower seed fill, we're probably not going to have as much photosynthates being produced. So the top end really is getting cut short right now.
Do we have any work anywhere that suggests how much this will be cut off or not?
You know, a lot of that work that's been done on temperature effects on soybeans, they're in growth chambers, they're on older lines, so be hard-pressed to know how much we are really cutting off. But let's put it in perspective. Last year, this time period, had the 85-degree weather, good sunlight, good soil moisture. State average within Indiana was 57.5. I think we're going to be hard-pressed to get anywhere near that this year with this kind of condition. On order of how much do we typically pack on, last year we're packing on about 2.5 bushels per acre per day during the seed fill. This year, I don't think we're going to be anywhere near that number.
Another question for you. For the last 3 years, and this looks like it'll be year four, soybeans have been the bigger money maker for farmers. That's a bit unusual. Some have looked at it and said, hey, wait a second, can I do soybeans after soybeans? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you can certainly do soybeans after soybeans, but we have to be a little bit more of a manager with that. It's going to, okay, do we know what kind of pressures that we're going to have? In other words, are we going to have disease pressure? Certainly there's going to be more opportunities for, let's say you're in white mold territory and you're going back to soybeans. You need to make sure that you're being proactive in that management. Another big ticket item is going to be what are our nematode pressures. And in particular, need to know what the levels are in your fields, but then also the types. You know, knowing what HG type you have goes to the decisions that a lot of guys are making right now at the field days because they're getting early discounts on seed. Whether they know how well those varieties actually perform because the combines haven't gone in, but they need to be selecting varieties that have the resistance to the nematode populations you have.
Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you.
That, of course, is Sean Castile. He is a soybean specialist here on the Purdue campus in Lafayette, Indiana.
It's National Napoleon Day. It's also St. Regina Day, patron of shepherdesses. On this day in agricultural history in 1822, a treadmill was completed to grind corn at the New York City prison. It employed the labor of 8 to 16 inmates at a time. They would walk on what looked like a very wide 5-foot in diameter paddle wheel. Prisoners held onto a bar and climbed the paddle boards like endlessly walking on stairs. The contraption could grind up to 50 bushels of corn a day. In 1840, Luther Cromwell was born. An American inventor, he designed a machine to make square-bottomed grocery bags. Those bags are still in service today. In 1912, David Packard was born. He, along with William Hewlett, founded the Hewlett-Packard Company. Before they became famous for computers and printers, some of their early inventions included an automatic urinal flusher and a weight loss shock machine. And in 1948, the first rubberized asphalt road surface in the U.S. was applied to a mile-long stretch of Exchange Street in Akron, Ohio. The paving mixture contained as much as 11 pounds of crumbled synthetic rubber per ton of asphalt. It was thought the rubber would make the pavement more durable and safer in extreme weather, but that was not the case. And by 1959, rubber was no longer used as an asphalt additive. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason, coming to you today from the Beck Agricultural Center on the West Lafayette campus of Purdue University, where I'm hosting their field day. Thanks to them for having me out. We're now joined by Mike Tenora. He's at T-Storm Weather in Chicago. Hey, Mike, thanks for being with us. Let's start here in the Midwest. We had a really cool August. How cool was it, and what are your expectations in the month of September?
August will rank around number 10 coolest of the last 123 years in the U.S. Corn Belt, so it was unusually cool. But it won't go down as one of the very, very cool ones like we saw in 1927 and 1992. Those were the very two coolest. But it will go down as one of the cooler, and things are actually going to warm up now. Even though today is a good example of how cool it's been lately, we start to turn things around here over the next couple of days, and we'll start to see 70s and 80s going forward as opposed to 60s and 70s. And the very small frost risk that we had over the last couple of days is now over, with another frost not foreseen.
What do you see for this week and then next week in the forecast across the Corn Belt?
There's not a whole lot happening in the central U.S., and that's because we have a large upper-level high off to the west. That feature is blocking weather systems from moving into the central U.S. And because of that, we just don't have a lot of humidity or a lot of energy available to produce rain. It will pretty much be high and dry here for a while. We don't see another chance for significant rainfall in the central U.S. for a while. You could argue maybe a couple of thunderstorms next Friday, Saturday, Sunday. That's still 7 to 10 days out. Even that chance doesn't look too good. And the only other thing you would have to keep an eye on would be the remnant circulation of Irma next week. Hurricane Irma is currently out in the Atlantic. There are a few hints that its remnant could make it as far north as parts of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio come Tuesday, Wednesday next week. But at this point, we think that chance is fairly low, with rain chances much higher as you move to the east of those regions.
And one final thing, and this may be related to Irma, and I don't know how far this will back up into the Corn Belt, but are we likely to see cloud cover that would restrict sunshine as we close out our season?
I wouldn't look for that to be a significant factor. As the remnant circulation of Irma does get closer, because it will eventually end up in the eastern U.S., and it wouldn't be at all surprising to see high-level cirrus clouds from that system across a big chunk of the Corn Belt, especially to the east of the Mississippi River, that would only block out the sun a little bit, not a real big deal. At this point, we're looking for fairly dry conditions and fairly mild conditions over the next 10 to 14 days, with the only real risks to the U.S. coming entirely from that Hurricane Irma system.
That's Mike Tenore. He's with T-Storm Weather and helps us wrap up this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report, coming to you today from the Beck Agricultural Center at the West Lafayette campus of Purdue University. I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for agricultural weather on WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey. Whether out of town or out of time, with Busey's mobile, deposit checks, view balances, and pay people and bills from your device. Busey, your dream, our promise.